University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Session 2009. English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you're doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Where will the tour meeting take place?
This letter says that all parents are requested to attend a meeting about the sports tour on the 21st of the month.
Oh, where, Dad? In the sports hall?
No, in the main school hall at 6:30 p.m. We have to supply a photocopy of your passport and medical details too. This letter says that all parents are requested to attend a meeting about the sports tour on the 21st of the month.
Oh, where, Dad? In the sports hall?
No, in the main school hall at 6:30 p.m. We have to supply a photocopy of your passport and medical details too.
Question 2. How will teachers know who wants to attend their revision class?
Have a look at the revision timetable for the coming 3 weeks. It's on the wall by the door. Write your name next to the lessons you want to attend, please. There are workshops during lunch breaks. For all science subjects this week, extra classes for languages next week, and others the week after that. All between 12 and 2 o'clock each school day. Have a look at the revision timetable for the coming 3 weeks. It's on the wall by the door. Write your name next to the lessons you want to attend, please. There are workshops during lunch breaks. For all science subjects this week, extra classes for languages next week, and others the week after that. All between 12 and 2 o'clock each school day.
Question 3. What is Lily's problem, and how might this be resolved?
What are you going to do during the holidays, Lily? Are you free from the 5th to the 7th of January? If so, you can be my partner in the doubles tennis tournament.
Well, Shania, I'm going to stay with a friend, but I'll be back in the evening of the 4th, so yes, I'll do that. I haven't played much tennis recently, though. The weather has been so bad.
Let's do some tennis practice now, then, to prepare ourselves. What are you going to do during the holidays, Lily? Are you free from the 5th to the 7th of January? If so, you can be my partner in the doubles tennis tournament.
Well, Shania, I'm going to stay with a friend, but I'll be back in the evening of the 4th, so yes, I'll do that. I haven't played much tennis recently, though. The weather has been so bad.
Let's do some tennis practice now, then, to prepare ourselves.
Question 4. Where exactly is the computer shop located?
Excuse me, I need some parts for the computer. Is there a computer spares shop anywhere near here?
Yes. Go round the corner and you'll see a narrow lane. Go to the end and you'll see the shop. I think it might be shut for lunch at the moment, but it probably opens again at about 3 o'clock.
Excuse me, I need some parts for the computer. Is there a computer spares shop anywhere near here?
Yes. Go round the corner and you'll see a narrow lane. Go to the end and you'll see the shop. I think it might be shut for lunch at the moment, but it probably opens again at about 3 o'clock.
Question 5. Why does Javed have to go to the shop?
Have we got everything for the party in the picnic bag, Javed?
Let's see. Balloons, cake, candles, knife.
What about matches to light the candles?
Oh, dear. I don't think I've brought any with me. I'll just go and buy some now.
Have we got everything for the party in the picnic bag, Javed?
Let's see. Balloons, cake, candles, knife.
What about matches to light the candles?
Oh, dear. I don't think I've brought any with me. I'll just go and buy some now.
Question 6. What are the disadvantages of taking the bus or a taxi into the city centre? Give one detail for each.
Which is the best way to the city centre, please?
Take bus number 12A. It's very cheap, but it only goes every 2 hours. It might be better to take the train. The station is just over there. There are trains every 20 minutes, and it's only 2 stops into the centre.
OK, but a taxi would only take a couple of minutes, wouldn't it? How much would that cost?
At least double the train fare. It is actually quite far away.
Which is the best way to the city centre, please?
Take bus number 12A. It's very cheap, but it only goes every 2 hours. It might be better to take the train. The station is just over there. There are trains every 20 minutes, and it's only 2 stops into the centre.
OK, but a taxi would only take a couple of minutes, wouldn't it? How much would that cost?
At least double the train fare. It is actually quite far away.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview about songbirds in Thailand and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Welcome to our weekly programme which looks at nature around the world. Today we are going to hear about singing doves. Here is our expert Mrs. Toom to tell us more.
Well, ever since a dove brought an olive branch back to Noah, this bird has become a symbol of peace and good fortune all over the world. Households in Europe traditionally used to keep doves in their gardens. In the Far East, a turtle dove singing sweetly is still an essential feature of family life.
That sounds lovely.
Yes. In southern Thailand, one particular bird is very famous for its song. It's called the zebra-striped dove.
Are there lots of them?
Yes, and their breeders always try to get a perfect bird that will get its song just right. You see, the birds are trained to sing by their owners, and there are even competitions and festivals for this.
Who are the breeders?
They're farmers living mainly in the southeast of the country.
How do they teach the birds to sing?
Each family has a dove which accompanies the master of the house all day. He even takes it on trips to the market. He attaches the cage with the bird in it to the handlebars of the delivery bicycle and then sings to it as he rides.
So they have intensive singing tuition, really?
Exactly that. They learn to sing, and they are given vitamin supplements and tasty food in return. This is to ensure that they look good and sing well, but only when commanded to do so.
So that they can win singing competitions or festivals?
Yes. Every year there are huge competitions. If you visit, you'll see hundreds of birds with their cages held up in the air on bamboo poles being assessed for the quality of their song. Judges move from pole to pole, listening and comparing before announcing the winners. Often the result and the winning prize, which carries a lot of money, can bring a complete change of lifestyle for the lucky bird's owner.
Because of the win?
Exactly. Wealthy people will pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for winning birds with previous success in competitions. A single egg from one of these birds might be worth more than the owner would earn from his farming in 10 years.
So it's not enough for these birds just to sing melodiously, is it? The birds have to sing in a very particular, well-trained way.
Yes, and only when told to do so by their owners.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Welcome to our weekly program, which looks at nature around the world. Today, we are going to hear about singing doves. Here is our expert, Mrs. Toome, to tell us more.
Well, ever since a dove brought an olive branch back to Noah, this bird has become a symbol of peace and good fortune all over the world. Households in Europe traditionally used to keep doves in their gardens. In the Far East, a turtle dove singing sweetly is still an essential feature of family life.
That sounds lovely.
Yes. In southern Thailand, one particular bird is very famous for its song. It's called the zebra-striped dove.
Are there lots of them?
Yes, and their breeders always try to get a perfect bird that will get its song just right. You see, the birds are trained to sing by their owners, and there are even competitions and festivals for this.
Who are the breeders?
They're farmers living mainly in the southeast of the country.
How do they teach the birds to sing?
Each family has a dove which accompanies the master of the house all day. He even takes it on trips to the market. He attaches the cage with the bird in it to the handlebars of the delivery bicycle and then sings to it as he rides.
So they have intensive singing tuition, really?
Exactly that. They learn to sing, and they are given vitamin supplements and tasty food in return. This is to ensure that they look good and sing well, but only when commanded to do so.
So that they can win singing competitions or festivals?
Yes. Every year there are huge competitions. If you visit, You'll see hundreds of birds with their cages held up in the air on bamboo poles being assessed for the quality of their song. Judges move from pole to pole, listening and comparing before announcing the winners. Often the result and the winning prize, which carries a lot of money, can bring a complete change of lifestyle for the lucky bird's owner.
Because of the win?
Exactly. Wealthy people will pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for winning birds with previous success in competitions. A single egg from one of these birds might be worth more than the owner would earn from his farming in 10 years.
So it's not enough for these birds just to sing melodiously, is it? The birds have to sing in a very particular, well-trained way.
Yes, and only when told to do so by their owners.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following interview with the manager of a road tunnel and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello and welcome to Safety First. Today, Mr. Kamani, the manager of the St. Gotthard Road Tunnel, is here to tell us about safety procedures in his tunnel.
Yes, I look after the longest road tunnel in Europe. It's the St. Gotthard Tunnel, which runs under the Swiss Alps. It's 17 kilometres long and takes the traffic through the south of Switzerland to and from the north of Italy.
Is yours the only tunnel, or are there other ways of driving across the Alps?
There are many tunnels and, of course, many mountain roads or passes which are open in the summer months. We also have a very picturesque mountain pass above our tunnel. The pass is 7 kilometres longer than the tunnel route, but there are no delays there. Better, perhaps, than queuing for the tunnel beneath.
Queuing?
Oh, yes. Think how much traffic pours off a 3-lane motorway. The tunnel has only 1 lane in each direction, so there can be a wait from the motorway to get into it. We can't allow too much traffic inside at once, as it would be unsafe, so we use a traffic light system.
Can lorries go through the tunnel as well as cars?
Yes, from Monday to Friday we allow lorries through. There is also an emergency tunnel for rescue vehicles, and there are many emergency stopping bays and exit steps in case of accident or fire.
And do you have to evacuate the tunnel very often?
Now and then. But the most common cause of delays within the tunnel is people running out of fuel. We do warn people to get extra petrol at the service station just before the tunnel. Also, sometimes cars break down. But generally, the tunnel traffic runs well.
You must have all kinds of safety measures in place.
Yes, but most are obvious. We insist that motorists observe the speed limit and keep a good distance away from the vehicle in front. We remind drivers not to try to turn round or drive backwards. We also broadcast tunnel news on the radio to keep travellers up to date with the current situation.
What are the busiest times to travel then?
During rush hour, of course, as a lot of people commute using the tunnel. So it's best to avoid using it between 7 and 10 in the morning and between 5 and 7 in the evening.
Do you have to pay to use the tunnel? Is there a toll?
Motorists buy a yearly pass to use all the local motorways, and the tunnel is included in these roads, so it isn't expensive to use.
What are the advantages of using the mountain road pass instead?
Well, the scenery, the lake, and museum at the top. The freedom to stop when you wish. In the tunnel, you must drive for 17 kilometres without stopping, and with nothing but the tunnel walls to look at.
So, how can the motorist decide which route to choose?
You can see all this for yourself on our website at www.tunnel.tcs.ch and then decide which route to use, over or under the mountains.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello and welcome to Safety First. Today, Mr. Kamani, the manager of the St. Gotthard Road Tunnel, is here to tell us about safety procedures in his tunnel.
Yes, I look after the longest road tunnel in Europe. It's the St. Gotthard Tunnel, which runs under the Swiss Alps. It's 17 kilometres long and takes the traffic through the south of Switzerland, to and from the north of Italy.
Is yours the only tunnel, or are there other ways of driving across the Alps?
There are many tunnels, and of course many mountain roads or passes which are open in the summer months. We also have a very picturesque mountain pass above our tunnel. The pass is 7 kilometres longer than the tunnel route, but there are no delays there. Better, perhaps, than queuing for the tunnel beneath.
Queuing?
Oh, yes. Think how much traffic pours off a 3-lane motorway. The tunnel has only 1 lane in each direction, so there can be a wait from the motorway to get into it. We can't allow too much traffic inside at once, as it would be unsafe, so we use a traffic light system.
Can lorries go through the tunnel as well as cars?
Yes, from Monday to Friday we allow lorries through. There is also an emergency tunnel for rescue vehicles, and there are many emergency stopping bays and exit steps in case of accident or fire.
And do you have to evacuate the tunnel very often?
Now and then, but the most common cause of delays within the tunnel is people running out of fuel. We do warn people to get extra petrol at the service station just before the tunnel. Also, sometimes cars break down. But generally, the tunnel traffic runs well.
You must have all kinds of safety measures in place.
Yes, but most are obvious. We insist that motorists observe the speed limit and keep a good distance away from the vehicle in front. We remind drivers not to try to turn round or drive backwards. We also broadcast tunnel news on the radio to keep travellers up to date with the current situation.
What are the busiest times to travel then?
During rush hour, of course, as a lot of people commute using the tunnel. So it's best to avoid using it between 7 and 10 in the morning and between 5 and 7 in the evening.
Do you have to pay to use the tunnel? Is there a toll?
Motorists buy a yearly pass to use all the local motorways, and the tunnel is included in these roads, so it isn't expensive to use.
What are the advantages of using the mountain road pass instead?
Well, the scenery, the lake, and museum at the top. The freedom to stop when you wish. In the tunnel, you must drive for 17 kilometres without stopping, and with nothing but the tunnel walls to look at.
Hmm. So, how can the motorist decide which route to choose?
You can see all this for yourself on our website at www.tunnel.tcs.ch and then decide which route to use, over or under the mountains.
That is the end of question 8. In a moment you will hear question 9. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 9. Listen to the following interview about prime numbers and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Welcome to Mathematics for You. Today we're going to discuss the discovery of new prime numbers. Our expert, Pritam Singh, is here in the studio with us to explain more.
Yes, recently you may have heard reports on the radio or television news, or even read in the newspapers, about the search for and discovery of huge new prime numbers.
Well, no, not really.
And the internet-based search with a $100,000 prize for the discovery of the first 10 million digit prime number.
No. Tell us what a prime number is first.
It's a number which only divides by itself and 1. No other number will divide into a prime number. Only 1 and the number itself.
So numbers like 2 and 3 are prime?
Yes. And then 5, 7 and 11, 13, 17 and 19.
Oh, they sound easy to find.
Yes, between 0 and 20 they are. There are 4 prime numbers between 10 and 20, as we have just said.
Don't they keep that same sort of pattern?
Oh, no. Between 110 and 120, for example, there is only 1 prime number.
113 at a guess.
Absolutely right. Over 2,000 years ago in Alexandria, a man called Euclid, a mathematician known as the father of geometry, looked at prime numbers just as we have been doing today. His question was, as numbers increase into thousands and millions, do prime numbers become ever more rare?
And do they?
Yes. But Euclid also wondered this. Do the gaps between prime numbers become eventually so huge that the list stops, or do they go on forever?
You mean he wondered if there really is a biggest prime number?
Yes. Actually, Euclid went on from there to prove that there is no end to the possible list of prime numbers.
How did he do that?
Well, very roughly, he said that we can multiply all our known prime numbers together and add 1, and we get the next prime number, and so on forever.
Well, why is this all so important?
Prime numbers are used as keys for codes to protect privacy. For example, prime numbers are used when you send payment details on the internet. They are also used by governments for global security issues.
Very complicated. So they do actually have a practical application in our everyday lives, then? They're not just theory.
Certainly not. Every time you do a transaction on the internet, you're unknowingly being protected by prime number codes.
Interesting. What's all this about new discoveries, then?
Since Euclid's time, mathematicians have searched for the next prime number and the one after that. The most recent prime number has 9.8 million digits.
Wow!
There's prize money offered for the first 10 million digit prime number. So don't forget to log on to www.primenumbers.com if you find it.
Good luck with the search.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Welcome to Mathematics for You. Today we're going to discuss the discovery of new prime numbers. Our expert, Pritam Singh, is here in the studio with us to explain more.
Yes, recently you may have heard reports on the radio or television news, or even read in the newspapers, about the search for and discovery of huge new prime numbers.
Well, no, not really.
And the internet-based search with a $100,000 prize for the discovery of the first 10 million digit prime number.
No. Tell us what a prime number is first.
It's a number which only divides by itself and one. No other number will divide into a prime number. Only one and the number itself.
So numbers like 2 and 3 are prime?
Yes. And then 5, 7, and 11, 13, 17, and 19.
Oh, they sound easy to find.
Yes, between 0 and 20 they are. There are 4 prime numbers between 10 and 20, as we have just said.
Don't they keep that same sort of pattern?
Oh, no. Between 110 and 120, for example, there is only one prime number.
113, at a guess.
Absolutely right. Over 2,000 years ago in Alexandria, a man called Euclid, a mathematician known as the father of geometry, looked at prime numbers just as we have been doing today. His question was, as numbers increase into thousands and millions, do prime numbers become ever more rare?
And do they?
Yes. But Euclid also wondered this. Do the gaps between prime numbers become eventually so huge that the list stops, or do they go on forever?
You mean he wondered if there really is a biggest prime number?
Yes. Actually, Euclid went on from there to prove that there is no end to the possible list of prime numbers.
How did he do that?
Well, very roughly, he said that we can multiply all our known prime numbers together and add one, and we get the next prime number, and so on, forever.
Well, why is this all so important?
Prime numbers are used as keys for codes to protect privacy. For example, prime numbers are used when you send payment details on the internet. They are also used by governments for global security issues.
Very complicated. So they do actually have a practical application in our everyday lives, then? They're not just theory.
Certainly not. Every time you do a transaction on the internet, you're unknowingly being protected by prime number codes.
Interesting. What's all this about new discoveries, then?
Since Euclid's time, mathematicians have searched for the next prime number and the one after that. The most recent prime number has 9.8 million digits.
Wow!
There's prize money offered for the first 10 million digit prime number. So don't forget to log on to www.primenumbers.com if you find it.
Good luck with the search.
That is the end of question 9. In a moment, you will hear question 10. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 10. Listen to the following talk by a librarian and then answer the questions below. You will hear the talk twice.
I work with books. I'm a librarian. Yes, I work in libraries, as you would expect, but not the type of public lending library you find in your city, town, or village. Although I have enjoyed many years of working in such places, I am now employed by an international organization which is dedicated to saving historical sites. I take care of a range of libraries in old houses. I help to look after these libraries and to preserve the wealth of old books and information. The most fascinating aspect of these book collections is really the stories of the people who once owned them. I am responsible for 160 libraries, comprising 230,000 books and manuscripts. Some of the books date from the 7th century, and some are right up to date. I look after books written on palm leaves, pamphlets on rat catching, which date from the 17th century, and even early editions of masters such as Shakespeare. Former world leaders are among the original owners of some of these volumes. They have now donated them to the public for research and interest, along with their houses. The largest library under my care has 12,500 books, and the smallest, just 3 books, all of which have to be carefully catalogued, protected, and regularly cleaned. Reading any of our collections informs you about people and places, interests, and everyday life at various times in history. I read through everything, and I'm eventually going to establish an online catalogue to make these collections available to the whole world. Apart from general care and cataloguing, I also sift through the books to see what they reveal about the people who owned them. Often there is a loving inscription just inside the front cover of a book, which may have been, for example, a birthday present. People that we have never heard about in history books can become living characters through their own collections. Before the 17th century, books were displayed with the spine out of view. The spine is the edge where the pages are bound together. These were known as front-edge books, and their titles were written by hand over the front edge, which faced outwards. Some of these books even have pictures painted on the edge in view. I have just supervised the cleaning of one of our smaller collections of old books. It took 425 hours. It's worth it, though, because having the libraries in a usable state helps to bring the old houses to life too. That, in turn, brings visitors to the old houses to find out more about their history and to study them. However, it's becoming very difficult to add to these collections now, because a book which cost less than £1 in 1930 could now cost us up to £15,000. Some people think that we don't need books anymore as we move into a digital age. But how else are we really going to find out firsthand about historical and social life in former times, or about the people who once owned the collections? Books and people go together. You won't find one without the other.
Now you will hear the talk again.
I work with books. I'm a librarian. Yes, I work in libraries, as you would expect, but not the type of public lending library you find in your city, town, or village. Although I have enjoyed many years of working in such places, I am now employed by an international organization which is dedicated to saving historical sites. I take care of a range of libraries in old houses. I help to look after these libraries and to preserve the wealth of old books and information. The most fascinating aspect of these book collections is really the stories of the people who once owned them. I'm responsible for 160 libraries, comprising 230,000 books and manuscripts. Some of the books date from the 7th century, and some are right up to date. I look after books written on palm leaves, pamphlets on rat catching, which date from the 17th century, and even early editions of masters such as Shakespeare. Former world leaders are among the original owners of some of these volumes. They have now donated them to the public for research and interest, along with their houses. The largest library under my care has 12,500 books, and the smallest, just 3 books, all of which have to be carefully catalogued, protected, and regularly cleaned. Reading any of our collections informs you about people and places, interests, and everyday life at various times in history. I read through everything, and I'm eventually going to establish an online catalogue to make these collections available to the whole world. Apart from general care and cataloguing, I also sift through the books to see what they reveal about the people who owned them. Often there is a loving inscription just inside the front cover of a book, which may have been, for example, a birthday present. People that we have never heard about in history books can become living characters through their own collections. Before the 17th century, books were displayed with the spine out of view. The spine is the edge where the pages are bound together. These were known as front edge books, and their titles were written by hand over the front edge, which faced outwards. Some of these books even have pictures painted on the edge in view. I have just supervised the cleaning of one of our smaller collections of old books. It took 425 hours. It's worth it, though, because having the libraries in a usable state helps to bring the old houses to life too. That, in turn, brings visitors to the old houses to find out more about their history and to study them. However, it's becoming very difficult to add to these collections now, because a book which cost less than £1 in 1930 could now cost us up to £15,000. Some people think that we don't need books anymore as we move into a digital age. But how else are we really going to find out firsthand about historical and social life in former times, or about the people who once owned the collections? Books and people go together. You won't find one without the other.
That is the end of question 10 and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers. Thank you, everyone.